My name is Ian Punnett, and the West Coast will be slipping over the line into 9/11 coming up in a few minutes, and then toward the end of the show, Hawaii as well. And for Alaska. Sorry about that. So I just want to make the point that while there is a weekend of commemorances of the 9/11 tragedy from 10 years ago, we are going to kind of talk about it from a couple of different aspects. At least I think they're different aspects tonight on Coast to Coast. And let me just say up front, I think you're going to enjoy hearing some of the personal experiences of people that were involved, directly involved in the 9/11 tragedy 10 years ago coming up this hour. But our main guests tonight coming up next hour on Coast to Coast wrote a very interesting book tying in 9/11 with evolution. It's about how the fall of the Twin Towers has the great potential of bringing about the rise of an enlightened humanity. I'm going to read, and I don't often do this, from the back of the book, verbatim. The book is called Ego, The Fall of the Twin Towers and the Rise of a New Humanity. It's the first book to explore the positive evolutionary potential hidden in what appears to be one of the most destructive events in history. Ego examines the evolutionary implications of 9/11 and its aftermath to argue not that we are falling into the grip of a new dark age, but that we are on the verge of achieving escape velocity into a much brighter one. It's a fascinating concept, and they do a great job with it. We'll get to that coming up next hour. All through reading the book, I was reminded of the Jewish tradition around the Passover Seder, where, you know, the youngest member of the family asks the four questions. The theme of which is Manishtana, what has changed? The four questions, sort of speak to the core of what the Passover Seder is about. And I think Manishtana is also relevant to our 10th anniversary here of 9/11. What has changed? How are we different? For good reasons and for bad, we have obviously been greatly affected as a country, as a people, perhaps even as a world by 9/11. The wars that continue to go on to this day have been brought about by that destructive event. So what could there be good in that? And how is it that we are actually evolving? We'll get into that coming up next hour. But first, let's talk about some of the people that were directly involved in the 9/11 tragedy. We'll start with a woman who was in the Pentagon when the plane slammed into the side of the building, narrowly escaping death herself. She has continued to fight for veterans, and she was one of the first to be allowed back in of the non-first responders back into the Pentagon. She'll tell us what she saw and why she was there, what she was doing that required her to go back in, coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So football games were being played today. Some great games were played today. Michigan barely beating Notre Dame. Notre Dame collapsing in the fourth quarter, it appeared. Great game between South Carolina and Georgia, amongst many others. Perfect fall weather pretty much across the country for these football games. A little hotter than average, perhaps, although cooler temperatures are coming this week. Same thing with Sunday. I mean, football games are going to get played. Life is going to go on. So what has changed? And how have you changed? How have I changed? What is changing about the human species as a result of 9/11? We'll talk more about that coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Retired Navy officer Cindy Campbell was stationed at the Pentagon at the time of the terrorist attack, and she joins us here on Coast to Coast. Good evening, Cindy.
Oh, good evening. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah. You know, your experience is very interesting, both before, during, and after the 9/11 attack of the Pentagon. So let's take a moment to talk about what you were doing. What was your assignment that brought you into the Pentagon before 9/11?
I was assigned there to the Chief of Naval Operations. That's the highest echelon command in the Navy, and I was assigned to the Fleet Readiness Division.
And you had a specific task with fleet readiness that required, what, a security clearance? And
Pretty much everybody in the Pentagon has a security clearance. It's, for the most part, everybody that works there has to have access to classified information.
Your job in particular, though, required you to oversee what?
Well, I worked for the admiral that was in charge, and I did a various number of duties, including personnel security, the classified material security, administrative work, some manpower stuff. I did a lot of various tasks working directly for him.
So let's talk about the morning of 9/11 for you. Was the Pentagon on any kind of prior alert? Was there any word that had gone around? We know now in hindsight that there had been some discussion going on we should have been more aware of. But had you been hearing anything at all that made you fearful there might be a Pentagon attack?
Oh, not prior to the day, no. Now, after the Twin Towers were hit, yes. I mean, I think all of us were painfully aware of the fact that we were in the symbol of the nation's military might, the Pentagon, and that it could be a target.
And so what precautions did they send out an alarm? Did they hit a button? Did you get it? I mean, what anything that they had done that made your day suddenly different after the Twin Towers had been attacked?
No, nothing. No, there was no alarm or no evacuation. I mean, everything happened very quickly. Remember, we were hit in the Pentagon not that long after the Twin Towers were hit. So there's really, honestly, wasn't enough time for folks to really have some forethought and think about evacuating the building. Then the next thing you know, the plane hit. And, I always tell people we're very lucky that day. The plane hit, of all the sides to choose, the terrorists chose, they chose the side that was, for the most part, mostly empty. There weren't that many personnel in the building. Estimates that I had heard was that if it hit any other side of the building, 600 to 800 people would have died. So it's very, very lucky. The plane hit a fairly empty section as people were moving from the old wedge to the new wedge, which was reinforced with steel bands around the stanchions. We had 2,000-pound blast-proof windows put in. Kevlar was put underneath the windows. One of those blast-proof windows saved a friend of mine on the C-ring. He would have died if it hadn't been for that window. So we were very lucky that it hit half of the plane, kind of went into the new section, and a portion of it went into the old section. Those that were in the new section fared a lot better.
So the you didn't see the plane coming?
No, I didn't see it coming. A friend of mine that worked at the Navy Annex on the Hill saw the plane, saw it physically, saw it. A lot of people saw it. And there's no doubt. I mean, when it hit, this was an incredible impact, as you can imagine.
Yeah. What was that like? What did it, the rumble of the floor, the noise? Did you know that you had been hit by something, or did you suspect it was, just a problem in the building?
No, I knew it was a plane. Because we had already been watching on TV the Twin Towers, we knew where we were working. We knew that there was obviously something going on. I mean, we knew. I knew it was a plane. Everybody around me knew it was a plane. But the thing is, it's still a jolt. It's still a shock, because no matter what, you don't think anything like that is ever going to happen to you. So it still is a bit of a shock. And, I was very fortunate. I came out of the E-ring exit, which E-ring means the outside, the outer ring of the Pentagon. So I came out into the outside portion, and I came out right where that plane came in. The emergency exit I used was right down at the apex of where that plane came in. And looked over my shoulders. I was getting out of the building and could smell the jet fuel, could taste liquid metal in my mouth. And, of course, I was pretty much engulfed in the black, very, very hot smoke.
What did you see on the ground?
Well, I couldn't see anything past the fireball. I mean, I came out fairly quickly after that plane hit. You really couldn't see anything because the fireball was so massive you couldn't see past it.
That moment when you come out, what is it then that you must do? You're you know, a human being, but you're also trained Navy personnel, and you know that there has been an attack. So what kicks in?
Pure adrenaline kicks in, and, you know, I tried to get as many people that were on the floor with me to the emergency exit, which leads you to the outer portion of you, to go outside of the Pentagon. And it's such a strange phenomenon in the Pentagon. Everybody that works there, you always go to the A-ring to exit the building. It's counterintuitive, but in order to come and go in the Pentagon, you go from the A-ring, B-ring, C-ring, D to the E, which is the outer ring, like a wagon wheel. But you always go, if you're going to go to the subway, the metro, or to the bus stop, or to the parking lots, you pretty much have to go to the inner A-ring to get back out. A lot of people were running to the interior of the building in order to exit, and they were using rote memory. And I was one of those people that was trying to get people to go out of the emergency exit outside, because we needed to get out of the building. It was on fire. So it's very important to get out of the building. So people did exit. Again, we were all very lucky that day. It could have been a lot worse. So mercifully, most people got out of the Pentagon safely. But then after that, you're standing outside and you're looking at this. I came out right where the plane came in, and I was very close to the fireball and very close to where the plane had impacted, and there was a bunch of us standing out there just kind of in awe looking at it. We couldn't get close to the fireball. It was too hot, and we had to exit away from the building fairly quickly.
Were the alarms going off, sprinklers going off?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I got out of the building. Most of us got out before the sprinklers even kicked in because you really had to get out fast. I mean, the black smoke was coming down the hall. You didn't need sprinklers to come on to tell you that
this
was
gotta go.
Not a good situation.
Right.
But, you know, most of the Pentagon did not have sprinklers. Only the wedge that had just recently been renovated, the one that I recently moved into in July prior to 9/11, they had sprinklers. That only one of the five wedges had sprinklers. This is why when you see later, a day later, the building was still on fire.
Right.
And the reason why it was on fire was because there was no sprinklers. And one of the other really interesting reasons is it was built for World War II at record speed, and they used horsehair insulation on the wire runs.
Oh, a famously fire-retardant horsehair.
Yes, and that caused a big problem for them because they couldn't, the wire runs, they couldn't get under control, and for about 2 days afterwards, you were still seeing firemen poking holes in the roof of the Pentagon trying to pour water down into those wire runs.
How about
that? I will tell you that the smell later, I was one of the people, my office had about 2 to 3 feet of water in it, and of course was damaged. We could not go back to the office space that we had. It was destroyed. But we were moved into another part of the Pentagon, the A-ring. The smell of the horsehair stayed in that building for months.
I bet. I mean, just because it's like any kind of hair burning, right? I mean, that kind of horsehair smell. Yeah.
The funny thing was, it just with the horsehair and the smell, because you got to have a little bit of sense of humor of this. But what the military did was they put these big blower units in the hallways and they stayed there for a good 6 to 9 months afterwards, trying to get the smell out, and the blower units had like a potpourri inside of it, and we couldn't stand it. It just made it worse. And so every night, it was really bad. Every night, our master chief would clandestinely go down and unplug it and push it into the Air Force base, and then about a couple of days later, it would find its way back to us. And so it was like a running joke of who was going to get the potpourri blower units.
Again, we're talking with retired Navy officer Cindy Campbell, who was around the corner of the Pentagon when the attack came on 9/11. And you lost many friends and colleagues in the crash?
I did. I knew a lot of folks that the Navy Operations Center was directly impacted. The plane flew right into it. And I knew a lot of those people in there.
I'm so sorry about your loss all these years later, but I know that you have made an effort to stay connected to veterans and to help prevent further tragedies in many different ways, including after you retired, you walked away from a fairly high-paying job you could have taken in the private sector, correct?
I did. I really wanted to devote my life to philanthropy, to charity work. I'd already done a lot of that in my military career, worked with the Department of Defense bone marrow program for a long, long time, 16 years, as a kind of a side job, a collateral duty, as we call it. But I wanted to do something more. I mean, this is one of the gifts of living through something like this, is to continue to give back. And I really feel strongly about it. I work for an amazing family. The Fisher family is just fantastic folks. They do a lot for our country. And we have a very well-run charity, and I think that's important for people to know about. You should always, before you give a penny to anybody, go to charitynavigator.org and check out the organization. If they don't have a high rating, you shouldn't give your money to them. It's to me, it's personal. We are so well-run. We have the highest ratings that you can possibly get. And we directly support the troops in a very tangible and lasting way. So that's part of kind of getting past the, sure, the tragedy and going on and doing something really positive.
Well, and what Cindy's talking about is Fisher House, which is a foundation that we've put a link up to at coasttocoastam.com. You can see the link for Fisher House. It is a great organization. I have spoken about it many times on Coast to Coast, and I go to my fallback shorthand description that it's like Ronald McDonald House for veterans. These are privately run, but in cooperation with the military. These houses, privately funded, provide a landing spot for families who are going to be with veterans who are getting what are oftentimes long-term treatments at these VA facilities around the country, these hospitals that are doing such good work. And even though the wars go on, and we know that there's, you know, sadly, there are still people being injured and killed all the time in Afghanistan. And there are still soldiers that are still, you know, in the fight against terrorism that started that day. Fisher House is right there with them and providing a safe, warm, I would say, delicious place to be, as great cooking goes on in every Fisher House, and everybody feels like they get a little bit of family and home, even when they're on the road for months at a time. Would that be about right, Cindy?
Oh, that's absolutely right. And in fact, we just opened our most recent Fisher House at the Washington, D.C. Veterans Hospital, and we have 5 at Bethesda. This is the new Walter Reed Bethesda compound. And we have 54, a total of 54 across the country. I mean, that is a significant number. And we also do the EuroMiles program. We give free tickets to military families so they can get back and forth to the bedside of their loved one at these military hospitals. We've given out almost 25,000 tickets. I mean, when you think about that number since this war began, that is a huge burden that we have lifted off of these families. So we're very proud of that. We can't do it unless people give us, donate their frequent flyer miles. We can't build houses unless people donate. I mean, our goal at Fisher House is to have a Fisher House at every single major VA hospital across the country. We already have them at all the major military medical facilities, but we're going all the way out in making sure that we cover all of veterans. And we have 23 million veterans in this country.
Yeah.
And here's a number that most people don't know. We have 2 million from this war alone. 2 million.
Veterans already.
Already from already. This war. That's a huge number.
Yep, and they need care, and we highly encourage you to go to coasttocoastam.com, click on the link for Fisher House, and know that your money is going to go to a great cause, providing these facilities as they continue to grow across the country. I had a couple more questions for you. Can you hang on for just a minute? Okay, we'll talk with Cindy Campbell. She was there at the Pentagon attack, and then we'll talk to a guy coming up who we've had on Coast to Coast before, who also was there the day of 9/11. He's the author of the book Scrambled. Martin Richard was scrambled that day. Now, he has gone on to have a career as a lecturer and somebody who works with businesses. But he has a very interesting perspective on what they went through the day they were scrambled for 9/11. And we'll talk to him about that coming up on Coast to Coast. And then next hour, We'll continue to discuss the day that changed the world. Actually, the day that two authors believe actually have changed humanity, changed us. We're watching evolution. We are experiencing evolution. Ego, the fall of the Twin Towers and the rise of an enlightened humanity coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Now, here's kind of the cool thing about one of the authors. Do you remember the band Tangerine Dream? Well, one of the authors next hour was a former member of the internationally acclaimed Tangerine Dream. Kind of cool. He's evolved, too, I think, from those days. We'll get to all that coming up. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. We're talking about 9/11, and there's a new book out talking about the evolution of the species since 9/11. More on that coming up. But if you go to coasttocoastam.com, there's also some great stories like the Trail of the Orang Pendek, Sumatra's mystery ape. Also, there's a great story about the Death Star, a Pentagon purchasing nightmare. It leads you to a link to Wired magazine. Cindy Campbell was there at 9/11, and she experienced what it was like to be in a building hit by a plane and to also be one of the first people let back in to the Pentagon of the non-first responders. We'll talk about that real quick. Why did she have to go back in, and what was she looking for, and what did it look like when she got back in there? Coming up next, and then we'll talk to a guy who was scrambled over the over Manhattan. He was in an F-15 with his finger on the trigger, ready to fire at any plane that didn't respond. And that in itself was kind of a paradigm shift, even for a combat veteran like our guest just a little bit later on this hour. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. By the way, my friend Russ Baker is going to be on tomorrow night with John B. Wells talking about some unanswered questions from 9/11. That's tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. Today is a day in which obviously many more commemorations are going to be held. There were some very interesting moments today. I don't know if you're following any of it on television. I know there's a lot of competition out there, but you ought to go back and take a look at some of the clips, especially about what happened outside of Pittsburgh. I was enjoying those memorial services, and it reminded me of Martin Richard and having to be scrambled for 9/11, being ready to shoot down any planes over Manhattan. We'll get back to that coming up in just a second. But Cindy Campbell, who's now with Fisher House, fisherhouse.org, helping military families. You can link up to them through coasttocoastam.com. It's a terrific cause. Providing a home away from home for military families while a loved one is being hospitalized for anything related to their service or even not. Cindy, you went back in. You were one of the first non-first responders to be allowed back into the Pentagon afterward. Why?
They let some of the folks come back in to, first off, just double-check and make sure all the classified material had been put away. Of course, on that day, everybody left. There was no locking up safes or trying to put things away. And so Defense Intelligence came in with a team of you know, experts that would classified access, and they basically put everything in burn bag and burned everything just to be safe. But some of us had to come back through and just double-check one more time and, you know, get the few items of personal effects on people's desks, because otherwise my entire section was getting basically gutted to start over again for construction. Right. But I had to go in and wear a Tyvek suit and a respirator. I think a lot of people don't realize, but the to the right of the plane, there were sprinklers, and water stood in that hot building that was, of course, part of it on fire for about a week or so. And it was moldy. It's hard to even describe. The mold looked like hair growing off of the wall. It was that bad. So it was a dangerous level of very dangerous spores.
Hmm. And as you went back into the building, what else did you see that we'll never see? I mean, photos in your mind that we'll never see.
The part that I walked back into was the newly renovated section, so it wasn't burned. So that was the good news, but it was certainly shaky, and part of it was destroyed. They wouldn't let us into the area that had, well, I could look down the hall and see the area that had collapsed, but they kept, it was just me and two other people from my entire office that got to go back in to do this. We had to walk on like a designated footpath along the wall so that the engineers were still a little concerned that the building could further collapse. So I wasn't real happy about having to walk back into a building that was not not stable. Yeah. But, you know, it's water damage, smoke damage, black smoke everywhere, a state of disarray as the firefighters went in and tore up the building trying to make sure that they were getting water into all the spaces that needed to be in there.
And you were able to get out what you needed to get out, and I'm assuming that you were aware that kind of there's a certain irony. The people that were the most protected were the people that were on the first floor, right? Isn't that what I understand? That if you were that was a safer place to be.
No, the plane flew into the first and second floor, so that's the floors that took the biggest brunt of damage. But of course, on top of that, the third and fourth floor, on top of right where the plane came in, was destroyed as well. Now, pretty much right where the plane came in, didn't matter what floor you were on.
No, I meant where you were, in the sense of getting out safely.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was lucky that I was a little bit further from to the right of where the plane came in.
Right.
So all of us to the right of that plane were able to get out because of that retrofit of that building, because the Pentagon had done such good, and they did a good job in renovating this building by reinforcing the stanchions, by adding the glass-proof windows. They did a lot of retrofitting to make sure that building was a little bit harder to take down. And it kept the to the right of the plane, it didn't collapse for about 30 minutes. And because of that, a lot of people were able to get out. So that was the good news about that renovation. And again, that 2,000-pound blast-proof window saved one of my friends' lives.
Well, thank you for your service to the country before 9/11, and you're doing God's work afterward with Fisher House. And I hope that we get a good response for the request for some contributions at the website at coasttocoastam.com. Because regardless of how people feel politically, these are still important people to take care of. Folks who are going to be struggling for years in many cases with injuries as a result of the war. Thank you so much, Cindy, for giving us the time to talk about your experiences at the Pentagon on 9/11.
Well, thank you.
And thank you, too, for a patient, Martin Richard, who is a pilot we've spoken with before on Coast to Coast. It's been a while. He's the author of Scrambled. Good evening, Richard. Martin Richard,
hey,
you there?
Hey, Ian, how are you? It's great to be with you again.
There is, and you too. You know, it's interesting for me. I thought of you a little bit as we were approaching the 10th anniversary of 9/11. You're one of the first people to put a book out talking about your experiences, and I am mindful of what I don't remember, but let's go over a little bit. You were on duty that morning. You were kind of on standby that morning. Had you already on 9/11 10 years ago already flown like a routine mission that morning as part of your regular readiness procedures?
Well, that was my job that morning, was to go in and train on a normal training mission like we had, you know, for years before. And at the base where I was stationed on Cape Cod, we also had an alert mission that required, you know, a certain amount of jets and personnel allocated just for that mission, ready to go on a moment's notice. So that was separate. We all did that. But, you know, that day, 10 years ago, my job was to go out and train.
And so you, at some point, you came to realize that it sounds like we're at war. When did you find out that the World Trade Center had been hit? Where were you when you heard it?
Well, interestingly, we watched the first two jets get scrambled, and you know, we had seen that happen before. We had no idea what was going on, and basically what we did was get out of their way so they could get airborne as quickly as possible. So then I arranged my formation, and we took off to our training area just south of Cape Cod, and one of those events that you'll never forget, and the hair standing up on the back of your neck, was when the Boston Center controller cut in on our frequency and said, hey, there's something going on at the World Trade Center, and we think you better get back to base as soon as possible. And the reason that was so unusual was that our training airspace is pretty much sanitized from any civilian air traffic, but also from radio traffic, because that's an important part of our mission. And to have him sort of break in on us was, you know, completely out of the ordinary.
And in this case, you saw two jets scramble, but you didn't necessarily know why they were scrambling before you. Did I lose him? Martin? Did something happen with Martin's line? He's not responding. Well, I'm sorry about that, because Martin is one of the few people who has the distinction of having been given the order to shoot down any civilian plane or helicopter that refused to identify or couldn't be identified. As a 102nd fighter wing pilot, he had combat experience, but in my previous conversations with him before on Coast to Coast, it was pretty clear that this was not any kind of order that he had a lot of time to process. You know, we can talk about it kind of intellectually about shooting down a plane full of civilians. But for him, it was an order, and he had to follow it, and he had to get good with it, and he had to get good with it right away. Do we have him back yet? Okay, Martin, I don't know what happened there. You okay?
I am.
Okay. So talk about that. When you got the order, you were then instructed to fly south to Manhattan?
Right. We actually went back and landed, and they refueled the jets and loaded them up. We took off again, and as four airplanes, we went up to Boston, and then NORAD said, hey, we're going to split two of you back down to New York City. So we left two over Boston and two over my wingman and I went down over New York City.
At what point did they tell you that it will be your job to shoot down any plane or helicopter that doesn't respond?
Well, you know, there was no rules of engagement for something like that. And we, you know, per se. So what happened was, as soon as we took off, we asked for our orders, and they said to intercept and identify, you know, basically any civilian airliner we were vectored onto. And they said that if there was no response, then you would have to be prepared, you know, for follow-on steps, which we all knew what that would be.
But they didn't tell you what those follow-on steps were. They just said, you got to be prepared for it, without saying explicitly, we'll ask you to shoot them down.
Correct. And you know, I mean, it was moving fast for them as well. And I'm sure they were, you know, trying to figure out the chain of events that would have to happen to get to that point as well.
And so what was that like for you? And as you were processing that, the thought that you might have to shoot down a commercial jetliner or some other craft filled with non-combatants.
It was a life-changing moment. I remember thinking to myself that, you know, I had been in combat before, but I did not want to do this at all. And you know, additionally, we worked with pilots in the airlines and you know, that would come out to the base as part-time pilots to train with us and in the F-15 as well as their civilian job. So, you know, there was all that sort of emotion brought into it as well.
So you fly over Manhattan and you see not just the scar in the landscape, but then the smoke.
Right. And, you know, that's another thing I'll never forget, is the picture in my mind of seeing lower Manhattan just covered in debris. And once we sort of got control of the situation, we realized that it was actually the second tower that had fallen. And of course, you know, in my own mind, that's when the switch flipped, and I, you know, just took a deep breath and said to myself, all right, well, now this absolutely has to stop.
Right. And your first thought was that it had just fallen over, or did you understand quite what was going on the ground from where you were?
Yeah, no recognition. I thought it toppled, and, you know, I couldn't take the time to process what that meant as far as casualties on the ground. So we just really focused up on the mission we had at hand.
Were you able, I mean, I don't know how high you were, you know, in relationship to the buildings, but I know I was listening today to a discussion about the fact that there was no rescue protocol from the Port Authority to be able to get people off the top of the buildings up there on the very top floor on the roof, essentially, of the World Trade Center. You couldn't see anybody, could you, from when you were going over?
Oh, no. We my two ship of F-15s got there as the second building was falling. And the first two guys who were scrambled, they actually did fly near the towers to see if anything or any rescue could be affected from the top. But, you know, just in debriefing and talking to them, that was not an option.
Right. Could they see people then?
You know, I don't know, Ian. I've never asked them that.
Yeah, the only reason I ask is it's just been haunting me all day. I heard about when they were coming to the realization that they just couldn't get helicopters up there and that they had never told anybody in the World Trade Center, hey, if there's ever a fire, go to the roof, because if the flames were coming up the top, they would prevent a helicopter from being able to get anybody. And it you could see that it was heartbreaking to them to know that people had done this, thinking that this might be a rescue. And of course, it was the worst possible decision to make, although there weren't many great options available to many of those people. So looking back on it, as you think about 9/11, 10 years later, what sticks with you, Martin Richard?
Just personally, from the perspective that I have, it's been interesting to talk to people on the ground. Some of the lasting images I have are just the sea of humanity that was streaming north out of the city as we were flying over them. And, I've had several people tell me that, they would hear a jet rumble and start to run or even just get down on the ground. And when they saw it was an F-15, that that was their hope.
Right.
So we were kind of their wingmen on the ground as well. And, that's a touching feeling to the work we were doing. But looking back, first of all, I can't believe it was 10 years ago, but I sort of take a more philosophical view of it now that I'm 10 years older and, try to put it in some sort of if not positive, at least a motivation to move forward, because, I'm sure that I'm like a lot of other people who were in close proximity to that event, that it's not just that day, it's the challenges you face, moving forward.
Sure. Well, and obviously you have to be relieved that you didn't have to fire on anybody. Are you 100% convinced you could have hit that button? If you had been told that the plane or the helicopter you were looking at was non-responsive?
At the time, like I said, when that switch flipped, we all knew that the attacks had to stop. And so we were prepared to execute any, legal order that we were going to receive.
Can't be easy. But no wonder, it gives you great insight, you are continuing to speak and be a motivational speaker for businesses across the country, and good luck with you on your career. You can link up to Martin Richard in the book Scrambled. You got a 10th anniversary edition, right, for Scrambled?
Yes, sir. I sure do.
Okay. Well, good luck to you with that, and thank you for giving us the time to talk about you as you look back on 9/11 as one of the F-15 pilots who was scrambled over Manhattan. He was the cavalry. He was there to help and to make people feel secure again. And yet that sense of security gets rattled when we hear about further promises, at least from some corners of Al-Qaeda, for another attack tomorrow. Grateful nothing's happened so far. Maybe this is nothing. Maybe this is all hype, but better to be safe than sorry, especially on the 10th anniversary. We'll talk about the fall of the Twin Towers and the rise of an enlightened humanity coming up next on Coast to Coast. And then tomorrow night, my friend Russ Baker, who is the guy who behind the website whowhatwhy.com, is going to be on to talk about some of the unanswered questions of 9/11. That's tomorrow night on Coast to Coast. And yes, you know, whatever it is you're going to do this weekend, I hope that you enjoy terrific weather and have a good time with your family. Do take a minute or two somewhere to honor those people who are lost. And if nothing else, go to some of those websites that are like ours at coasttocoastam.com, linking you up to the pictures of the new Ground Zero Memorial. Although we're not supposed to call it Ground Zero anymore. We're supposed to change that. I'll tell you about that in a second. We've been asked to stop calling it that. I don't think that's going to work, but I'll tell you more about that in just a second. And then we'll find out how we are evolving in front of our eyes. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.